My name is Dave Velasco, and I work in the Communications Department of the Toronto Public Library. And on behalf of the library, I'd like to welcome you to the Brand and Bluemont Hell Salon at the Toronto Reference Library and to the 10th anniversary of the Toronto Common Arts Festival.
For 6 years. said, is put up giant tents, just do everything as sort of an outdoor festival, have a street component, whatever. We kind of outgrew that too on the first year we did that, although that was a lot of fun, and I've been itching to do an outdoor event since then. In the rain didn't scare me away, not stupidly. And then in 2007, we decided, let's try to find a building with walls and a roof, and we went to Victoria College. And the thing about the 2003, 2005, 2007 things, that it just sort of grew a little bit every year. The big jump from 2003 to 2005 was the attendance. Because we were outside, because we were free, because you basically would trip over us, we attracted so many more people to the space. We quickly decided that we wanted more people there than we wanted the $5 for people at the door. So that became very, very quick. And then from 2005 to 2007, the audience stayed about the same because we weren't on Main Street. But we grew in terms of the number of exhibitors we had, and in terms of the programming that we did, and the way we reached out to people. Fun fact about the first couple of years, if you didn't live in Toronto or within driving distance, you were not allowed to come to TCAP. We turned down all kinds of exhibitors from California, from overseas, and from the West Coast, because we knew that as nice as the show as we were running, you couldn't make money at TCAP if you had to pay for an $800 flight. And TCAP exists because we wanted to give back to the local community, because we wanted to give back to artists. That's why we started making it free, and that's why we started promoting it the way we do, and so that artists could make a buck. It's really hard. It was a lot harder, especially 5 years ago, 10 years ago, to find a space for you to sell your zines and mini comics and make a few bucks and maybe pay your rent that month. And that was why we did it. In 2009, when we moved to the Reference Library, they actually invited Abe, who was just up here, to come see the TCAP 2007. So we've been talking about it. He's been working for Reference Library for long, with DPL and the Reference Library for a while, doing events. And we're like, do you think you guys could do something like this in your Reference Library space? And they came and they saw it, and they thought it was great. And we had, man, like 50 hours of meetings, because no one had ever tried anything before. Usually when people do events in the Reference Library, they go to the nice Beacon Auditorium downstairs, and they do an event, and like 100 people are really happy. And this, it brought in 12,000 people the first time we did it at the Reference Library. So they were shocked and happy and amazed. And then they opened up the house salons. We just doubled the exhibitors, and we started letting people come from door to door away. Because when you have that many people in the space, the artists that are here can make money. They can sell not just 10, but 20 or 40 or 100 copies of their book over the course of the weekend. I think our record, someone said they sold 400 copies of their book last year, and nothing makes me happier than artists making money. So that's pretty awesome for me here, and for the artists that are coming. And the festival grew the last 5 years. It couldn't have grown the way it did without TPL support, so Abe, thank you. We really do appreciate it. And all the people at TPL have them, and Catherine and Bill, so everyone, you don't get to see up on the stage or even at the weekend, because they do all the work ahead of time. Then they go, I think I'm going to go on vacation that weekend because 20,000 people in the library is not going to have a so thank you, Reference Library, and we appreciate that. This year was going to be a carbon copy last year, because I thought 2012 was really the first time that TCAP became in my mind what I set out to do, what we set out to do in 2003. We wanted to show that people could make money at it. We wanted to show that the public would attend. Wanted to show that ran smoothly because those headaches from those hiccups at the last minute are pretty killer. I'm a lot grayer than I was five years ago. So I should be here, which is the worst. We decided we would focus our efforts and we would go to Tokyo. Somebody's testing me drawing in the back. We would do this and we would start sort of preaching TCAP and preaching and spreading the gospel. Of having a free comics event that people should do. So we went to Tokyo this year and brought a bunch of cartoonists with us, and they were awesome. And we all had a good time in our exhibition and that kind of thing. And so when we got back, it turns out that every publisher we had ever worked with wanted to bring at least two of their guests, their biggest cartoonists here this year, and in some cases four or five from all over the world. So now we have 18-plus countries and 400 cartoonists and 24 featured guests, which is third more than last year, from this, which is the World of Taiyama Tsumoto, which is running the Japan Foundation. And we've never run a gallery exhibition by ourselves before. Usually we work with our consular partners to do that. They did an amazing job. And this time we were just like, yeah, we can handle this. It'll be a light year. It'll be an easy year. It wasn't. the exhibition looks awesome. You should all check it out. We're doing the library and educator again, or programming again this year, because it worked out really well last year. And we said, let's re-up that again. And we had, I think, 50% more people sign up, and more authors and more cartoonists wanted to be a part of it and speak to the library community and the educator community. And that was awesome. That more people are involved, and that we're spreading the gospel of TCAP and comics in sort of a different way as well. And of course, we have our event this evening, our kickoff, where I was just telling Tom before I came up, I've always felt kind of awful that we've never had the Hernandez brothers here in Toronto at the same time, let alone for TCAF. And it never worked out. Fantagraphics really like San Diego Comic Con, and you can blame them. But this year, just sort of pulled the trigger. I'd like to thank Brian Quarterly and Ted Burns and Fantagraphics for their support in bringing these two wonderful guests. But it was pretty much a revelation. And then following Lupa and then Little Good Stories, those nice big hardcovers that came out that sit proudly on my shelf was awesome. I'm very fortunate that we have both Deborah Hernandez and Jaime Hernandez here. I think we're all going to share in that good portion this evening as our distinguished moderator, Tom Spurgeon. ComicsReporter.com walks us through their career. As much as we get through in 45 minutes or so, it's a pretty long career, as I said. And also some of his own most deeply curious questions about their work and about their careers. So I'm going to turn it over to Tom now. Ladies and gentlemen, Tom Spurgeon.
Thank you for coming out. I think it's kind of appropriate that I just talk about where TCAF has been, because I'm going to take TCAF back to the very humble roots with 1998 technology and a belly full of late afternoon beer. So hopefully we can get through it, and it's my absolute pleasure to be here and doing this with you guys. So let's talk comics.
All right.
I can be a little stronger, I think, than Chris was, and I absolutely think none of this would be possible without these two guys. I think these guys are the source. I think these guys are the foundational comics, alternative comics, arts comics makers. And what's remarkable is if you look at them in the context of all artists, the fact that the year that they started doing comics, the comics that you guys did were some of the very, very best comics that year, and then the comics you guys are doing this year are going to be the very best comics of this year, is a remarkable thing. If you stop and think about music, if you think about prose, if you think about theater, if you think about movies, almost no one has a career that is that potent, that's over that span of time. So, an absolute incredible thing that we get to access them all weekend and get our stuff signed and get to talk to them. So, what a thrill. Jaime Hernandez is my favorite cartoonist, and I think I will say that right out. When I was 20 years old, I think I read The Death of Speedy, the remarkable Death of Speedy story, like 100 times maybe that summer, sitting in a crappy little apartment in the Midwest. Jaime's work is lovely, as you all know. It deals with deep and resonant themes of memory, and the power that memory and nostalgia has over us, and like his brother, absolutely unbelievable characters. And, of course, the remarkable thing, and why we have both gentlemen up on stage, is as amazing as Jaime is, he might not be the best cartoonist in his own family. Because Gilbert, I could sometimes refer to Gilbert as, you don't like?
Oh, that's okay.
Okay. Gilbert is, I sometimes refer to him as a future greatest living cartoonist for the breadth of his career. Gilbert has a career where not only could you maybe get two cartoonists worth of career just for the stuff that you've done with your brother and the Love and Rockets material and stuff that's come under that umbrella, but all the work outside that you've done. And you're just an amazingly prolific and powerful cartoonist. So it is an absolute pleasure. The fact that you guys are related is an astonishing thing. Right up there with the 30-year longevity of the potency of your career. So it's very intimidating to be sitting across talking from you guys. So let's talk about comics a little bit. And what I have is I have a bunch of slides that I slapped together at the last second because the other ones failed me. So we'll try to go along and have some illustration as we go. But mostly it's just going to be talk. One of the things that's been a great thrill about the revival of interest in you guys has been that we've gotten to see some old pictures, and we've gotten to see kind of go back and have, you know, memories of things. This is a picture that Diana Schutz took, I think, for science back in the day. And I kind of wonder, how do you guys, just because of the longevity of your career, how do you guys connect to the earlier you? Do you kind of see it as a continuity? Is it all one career? Do you look back at the cartoonists you once were? Do you recognize them? Do you feel pretty much the same as you did back then? Or is that a lifetime ago?
Well, no,
I'm still sitting in the chair for some of everything. Blonde hair.
We were playing bands at the time, so we had to have to look. So
we weren't going to make any comments with that, but so we didn't get involved. I feel like a sick person. I don't, I'm ancient and craggy now, I'm cranky. But when I was younger, I was ancient and craggy then too. But I don't feel any different. It's like anybody who says, oh, I should feel like I'm 30 years old, but I'm 109. I don't feel it's been 30 years. I feel it's been 5 or 6. Really. Time is, it's not there, but that passage of time. Yeah, I'm looking in the mirror and I try to catch up with my daughter. Yeah, the passage of time shows up. That's about it. I don't know.
I feel pretty much the same person, but I know over the years I've changed my approach to drawing a lot. Mostly recently because my back hurts more if I work too much. My hand gets more cramped up, stuff like that. But my approach to it's the same. I'm still that little kid who's I get to draw comics. Sometimes it's like, oh, I get to draw comics. But I still got that white eye thing. Like I got a fresh. Got a fresh new issue to draw that hasn't been touched, so I get it's really exciting to see what's going to go in it. Like I'm watching someone else do it,
Sure.
Kind of thing. So I've still got that wide-eye.
Let me ask this: the early part of your guys' career, images like this and that. I wonder. When did you know that you were kind of locked into being cartoonist? Because I can't imagine that. Did you know right away that this was what you were going to be doing the rest of your life? Were you hopeful? Was there a point at which where you went, oh my God, this is what I do now. I'm going to do this for a while now.
There was in the early issues of Little Rockets. Before that, we've been drawing kids literally since we were 5 years old. Mm-hmm. Different kind of, little scribbles, half comics, that kind of thing. But we were still interested in making a comic book. And that it wasn't until our late teens, that we started to develop that actually wanted to do comics that were going to be seen by people. So we had a jump start in Golden Rockets. We actually had done other comics for fanzines or even for ourselves. Properly done on proper sized paper, pen and ink, and lettered and stories. I remember in junior high and high school that whenever I did a drawing, some kind soul would say, you should draw comics for a living. What a nightmare. Are you kidding? I'm going to have a life when I grow up. I'm not going to draw comics. But now that I look back, it's because I just feared the idea of actually putting out my comics for public viewing, And then it got to a point where it got closer to, the Rockets, but it was still, you should work for Marvel Comics. You should work for DC. That was even a bigger nightmare. Because I didn't want to draw Spider-Man. I didn't want to draw Superman. Even if I liked those comics as a kid. All I knew is what I knew. I just knew about my life and the comics that I read as a kid. And all I knew is how to put those together. Even before the Rockets, I was doing more science fiction stuff, but it still had the same elements. They're more like science fiction stories of a Palomar type background, of course, there's like spacesuits and rocket ships and stuff. But I just didn't think of it as a career. I thought that wasn't a career for me because I just couldn't approximate what was in Marvel DC comics. I didn't like, by 1980, I didn't like Spider-Man comics anymore. I was wrong. But I looked at them and I'm like, yeah, I can't even do this. I don't like these comics, but I can't do this. I just went ahead and did my comics right away. So the big surprise was that we did our comics our way, the only way we knew how, and they were the response was immediate. They were liked, right? That surprised me. I thought, this is amateurish for me, at least. This is not, I can't put this out there. This doesn't look like a Spider-Man comic, but we got an immediate response to it. Do these comics now. We like your comics. And even though the group was small, it was enough encouragement for us to continue.
Was there a model or anything? Because you guys were kind of like your own thing, and certainly for some time. I remember if you read old, Comics Journal interviews, everyone should do that, spend a lot of time reading 1982 1984 interviews. But if you read old interviews, when they talk about what you guys do, sometimes from the older cartoonists, there's not even that process by which they recognized what you guys were doing as being professional cartoonists, that you guys were kind of in the fanzine world. I'm just saying the older guys, like, they couldn't even comprehend. Was that a struggle early on to kind of, because you were totally kind of making your own way. The undergrounds were gone. The overgrounds had really kind of fizzled even by that point. So you guys were kind of the model. You guys were your own thing. Was that tough at all to find?
Well, the tough part was that I hated was that we were looked at as a little curio kind of thing. You know, like, oh, Love and Rockets, how cute. You know. But I was cocky enough to go, I know what I'm doing here, man. You know, I'm working with something here. But other than that, I was just naive enough and cocky enough to go, well, I don't care, I'm going to do it anyway.
Part of our inspiration was the time was also working in the punk scene at the time. We got into the punk scene in the late 70s, and it was still pretty new. And, and fans that we liked, and the interviews we were in, fanzines, and the comics that were coming out after those fanzines at the time, they just didn't give a shit. They were just going to do it anyway, and they were just going to make noise, and they were going to make a racket, and they were going to do whatever. And we could see where bands could go. We're becoming, a stronger influence in music. And I think that's actually what destroyed the Clash, was they were the next Led Zeppelin. Nobody was prepared for that. Everybody thought it was going to be Led Zeppelin, Lawrence Bellins, and then Rock was going to turn into something else, another version of that. So when Clash and another band, some great like that came out, the pressure on them was so heavy, and I think that's what crushed a lot of those early bands, even though they were fantastic bands. I think that's what happened. And since we're into the LA punk scene, which is actually after all the other major scenes, well, the two major scenes, especially LA, from London and New York. I guess in Detroit and other places, but we were sort of behind on it. We were just building off that. And even if a lot of the bands weren't so great, the vibe and the atmosphere was so great that it just put a fury into us. It was more important than actually playing music. We liked playing bands and stuff, but doing comics was even stronger. Because you could reach more people. There's a big division in music. Well, you like hardcore, or you like prog, you like this and that. But in comics, you have that in the mainstream, but if you a black and white comic that was more undergroundish, it was more of interest from from people who were interested in that, a different kind of comic. A lot of the early, the older hippies looked at our comic and were like, oh, yes, it's black and white comics. You guys are coming from us. And I said, yeah, we are. And the mainstream will look at Hyman, who's a fantastic artist, and we're like, you're almost as good as a guy that can draw Conan. early on, there was a lot of attention. And luckily, and I think that's what really got Love and Rockets noticed, is that kind of skill and storytelling was so immediate to a reader, that they thought, like, they think that the mainstream artists actually were the first supporters of us. And once we started moving away from their interest, Rockets and spaceships, then they started going, what happened to the rockets? What happened to the spaceships and the monsters? And we're just more into characterization. And then we started building a following of that, and they sort of fell by the wayside with those fans. We still have a few of them, but they just weren't interested in. Because a lot of, if you dig deeper, a lot of mainstream fans do not like underground comics. If you'll notice, there's a very big separation of that. And we didn't care. Growing up, we liked things. Mad magazine, Hot Rod cartoons. We liked magazines, creepy and alien, black and white magazines. And there was comic books too, but we liked them all. We just liked the medium and the different ways they were done. So we never had a problem with division. That's why Love and Rockets is like an old comic store. There's just all kinds of stuff going on in it. And sometimes we'll back away from that, doing the day-to-day stuff. And then finally we'll just say, I haven't done a superhero story in a long time. And then we'll just do it. Because that's what comics books were to us, all kinds of things.
Now, would either of you be surprised, would the younger version be that you'd be surprised if you're still doing it? I mean, the energy of that time was very immediate. A lot of the bands that you were probably getting energy from, I can't imagine a lot of them are still around. You guys are, though, and as good as ever. I mean, did you think you'd be doing it?
It was not something we really thought about. Yeah. I mean, I had hoped that we could continue because I didn't want another job, But it was just something that, about me and Hildur, correct me if I'm wrong, that after we finish an issue, it was time to do the next one. And then the one after that, when that one's done, it was time to do it. And 30 years later, we're still doing that, you know. Oh, we finished that one. Okay. It's on to the next one.
Well, a long question would be, I mean, was it touch and go for a long time? Was it, I mean, what was the reality of it just in terms of getting to continue to do it? Was it tough? I mean, it might still be tough, but it's certainly, but I mean, was there ever a time where you thought you might not be able to continue just from the reality of it?
The reality is all simply finances. As far as our inspiration of wanting to do comics, that never wanes. You know, sure. Forever. But there are times when we think, like, you know, well, Love Rockets, you know, is really doing that. Well, let's change format. That's why it's always changing format. It's changing with the different way comics are being done. We wanted, literally, it was just dumb. Well, we changed from the magazine to the comic book because people complained too much that the magazine didn't fit their comic book boxes. So we went to the comic book. That, they didn't like that either. So I think you're like, oh, let's figure out a different way to do this. But we were doing that, and so Kim Thompson suggested, let's put out the book that is now the yearly annual, because basically the bookstores are complaining that we're not getting new stuff from the Hernandez brothers, we're just getting the reprints. So he suggested, how about going for the book market, since that's where your audience mostly is, you know, for our collections.
Right.
So we just gave it a try, and so far that's been working. It's a lot more laborious, because 50 pages each at a time, and it's tougher for us, but it's you know, it's worked out.
We have a couple of images of.
That's awesome.
I'm guessing that's from an old swimsuit, one of those old swimsuit issues in Amazing Heroes.
Yeah, Amazing Heroes. Kim would say, "Hey, you have your King drawings."
Yeah, which was they would do bikini issues of various characters, but you know, with a lot of different characters. I mean, I think is why I picked that image. Then one of the ads from back in the day. I guess, you know, one of the things that was odd about the way you guys were processed was that a comic like yours, because it was not those two companies doing superheroes, that was kind of lumped together, and you guys always got compared to some weird, like, not fellow traveler comics just because they weren't Superman, like, or they weren't the X-Men. Mm-hmm. It seemed like that you were in the everything else category. I wonder if it was ever frustrating or odd, or how you felt about some of the people that you were kind of seen as fellow travelers with. And was there a point at which, when kind of more alternative and characterization-based comics came along, that you were, that maybe you found your people, or that you found your fellow artists?
Yeah, it took a while, but I mean, I remember it was Love and Rockets and Cerebus, and then it was Love and Rockets and American Flag. And then it was, I can't remember other ones, but it wasn't until, you know, it was Love and Rockets and A-Ball that I kind of felt comfortable, really, because I, you know, we knew Dan, and we knew where he was coming from, you know, he was.
But yeah, when it was like, Love and Rockets, Washington and Dark Knight, those were the comics. You know, and it wasn't to be jerks or anything, but we really wanted to separate ourselves from that, because we weren't coming from there. Yeah, you're right, you used to figure out story. But it wasn't, we just wanted to distance ourselves because we're not deconstructing superheroes. But, you know, people like to read into that stuff. There's such, the Bronze Age, which is Marvel in the 1970s, had such a grip on fandom at the time, had such a grip on it that if it had a superhero in it, there was a connection to superheroes, that we were connected to superheroes somehow. Even though we're doing a parody or we're just doing a, you know, facsimile or whatever, there was a connection, and Love and Rockets was really about superheroes, but you didn't see them in the panels. That was really it all. We're like, no, we're not that, we don't want to fucking do them. I mean, but anyway, so we just want to push away from that. And yeah, it wasn't all superheroes, just because they're goofy, but not because we're getting kind of shocking at them. We want to be in there watching in the dark, or whatever horseshit is out there. You know, we just wanted to do a different thing. And our imaginations kind of go there. So I kind of did, you know, superheroes did.
Yeah.
Wait, did you guys feel a connection to the undergrounds then? I mean, because it's not, I mean, there was such, that whole milieu of expression kind of faded a bit by then, and you didn't see it everywhere, but material-wise, and the way they, you know, the kind of stories that some of those artists were doing, continuing to do, seemed like they would be better fits for you guys. Did you not, how do you feel you're different than the undergrounds? Do you?
It's hard to say. One of the things is that I've doing Love and Rockets before people like Klaus and people started coming out with their comics, I felt kind of think of the undergrounds. I like the undergrounds and the undergrounds I had read before, but we're kind of in this strange little world where we were supported by the mainstream and outsiders and stuff like that. So we didn't feel part of any scene or anything, you know. I don't know if I felt lonely about it. I mean, but it was just I don't know.
Well, I think you guys benefited from a retail system that at the time took very seriously having everything. And so when you went to a comic shop, like, there were comic shops that just for years would continue to have Love and Rockets that maybe didn't carry a lot of other stuff because they'd always kind of carried your stuff when back in the early 80s that was really important to them. But anyway.
Actually, a little bit on the undergrounds. I was a lot more influenced in the undergrounds because I'm older and I have them in my hands and like that. I looked at them and I was impressed with them. Pretty simply, they're freedom. You know, they're adults only, so they can do anything they wanted to, and they often did. You know, particularly the ones who start with me are Gilbert Sheldon, S. Clay Wilson, and Crumb, of course. And even in the wildness and the dirtiness and the creepiness of Crumb's work, I saw fiction there somewhere. I saw something in there that was more than just, you know, his satire, his nutty, you know, obsessions. I saw something more there. So for me, it was basically the freedom of the underground freed me to want to do comics. Like, at least comics existed, and they were, and believe it or not, in the late '60s, the underground comics sold very well. They weren't, you know, even Sergio Argonis, you know, the great mad artist, just said we and Mad were so jealous of the undergrounds. We were so jealous. We were just that they were so free, and we were straitjacketed by, you know, our mainstream type humor. Because even though we can go wild in politics and stuff, they could just push it as far as they could, and they couldn't. But even as artists, they said, because we were just so limited to that. And whereas the mainstream thought, or at least how it came out, was, you know, well, we have to do it underground, but let's turn our comics psychedelic. We'll get Jim Steranko and Neil Adams to do Devil Prince Square. They had to compete with the psychedelic era, like approximately an LSD trip in the comic books, you know. I've been told. So there's so for me, but going back to undergrounds is just very much a, you know. So what I criticize for going too far, being too sexy, too dirty, too exploitive, too violent, I don't go anywhere near what Crumb and Esquire Wilson did that. Yeah, I'm being criticized for being too wild. So.
How do you feel you're different? How do you feel your work is different than the underground stuff?
For me, I just think it's just fiction, you know, serialized fiction. Doing a long story is a story. You know, they're more into satire and shocking and making some kind of point, but it's a short term, mostly. Gilbert Sheldon did long stories, but they're more satirical, where I just want to do straight fiction, just stories of characters. That was my answer.
Well, that's actually a really convenient bridge to my next question, because when I look back at all the books that you've done, there's a period in which, like, the late 80s, early 90s, where people started to play around with longer-form comics, longer-form, you know, Mouse became very popular, and there were supposedly going to be things that came out after Mouse, and in 93, 94, you got Our Cancer Year and Stuck Rubber Baby, and some books that were bookstore-ready. A lot of the kind of books that we'll see at the festival kind of are in that same kind of model. That was an early flowering of those kind of books. But if you look back, and I don't know that you've ever gotten enough credit, there was a point at which in Love and Rockets where you just started to go very long and very ambitious. First with Human Dystrophism, which gets sold as Blood of Palomar, maybe, or it still does. And also with Poison River, the follow-up, and the band one, which is Love and Rockets X. Yeah. I mean, which are just these three really grand, lengthy, serious graphic novels that maybe didn't get attention as such at the time. And I wonder, when I looked at those, I mean, what made you kind of go long at that point? Because that was just, all of a sudden you started in these very long, ambitious, involved stories, you know, bam, 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 right after one another. And I wonder what took you there?
I always liked the idea of having a graphic novel, a book, mm-hmm. you know, a novel, more or less. One story, kind of like in one place, and it begins and ends. You know, I've always liked that idea. basically, the Charlton Courier comic was just one story in an issue that would have beginning and ending, and that was it. Marvel and DC weren't doing anything at the time like that. And that really fascinated me that somebody would just care to do a thing. So I'm a little glad to acknowledge that in one comic. And same with the Classics Illustrated. I mean, they were taking large novels and squeezing them into 40 pages, but the idea that you could put a book story in a comic book, it was very intriguing to me. I didn't do anything about little kids. I wasn't going to do it. I was going back to Superman comics or whatever. But I thought I liked the idea of it. And so when I saw little things popping up here and there, I thought, you know, like, what am I going to do? Contract with the objects, blah, blah, blah. Well, somebody can do this. Somebody's doing this, you know. Because when I saw a mouse for the first time, it was still a serial.
Sure.
Raw. So I didn't see it as a book yet in my mind. So I just wanted to do that. I mixed two things that I loved. I love the old comic strips, but they would do long stories. After now, we do a long story. And I thought if you just collected this into a book, it would be like a little novel or a little book. Anyway, I just liked the idea of it. And so I just was doing that in one of my pockets. I thought, well, this will be in a book someday. We'll put it together as a book. But I still had to serialize it because I couldn't do a book all at once the way I did Marvel season that way, but it took me 30 years to get to that point. You know, I had to go through the trial and error of doing it serialized first.
Well, can you give an example of something that you remember was a problem that you had to solve on the page, or something that was tough for you in getting those initial longer works out?
It was just that we weren't used to doing long things. we weren't used to, I'm going to do a 300-page book, and I'm just going to do it. I would have got more than 20 pages into it, you know. But the idea that we serialized things gave us a break. Because we still have to learn how to do comics. That's what we're doing on the comics. They're still learning. We had to learn. The first issue, I really cursed Gary Groff for this, for having to do 64-page comics the first time out. You know, but at the same time, I learned how to do a lot of work all at once. I learned through trial and error what it was like to have this exhausted job in front of me to complete, just to get an issue out. And that we did that for 4 issues. And even though, you know, I cursed Gary every day about it, at the same time it taught me how to do it. And so once we started doing the bi-monthly, the shorter comics, that became more of a group. Like, I was able to do it. So up to, gosh, up to recently, it's love and rock, it's still been a challenge just to get it done.
Yeah.
Because, but we just push ourselves.
And Jaime, you know, your work in the same period, you didn't go long, or you started to do longer works maybe a little later, but your work, there was a period in which, I guess maybe that same period, that late 80s, early 90s period, where it seemed to me like the work got a lot more, I want to say refined in a way. Like there was something about, I don't know if it was the quality of the drawing or kind of the potency of the stories. I mean, Death of Speedy is a very potent story, very strong scene work, and very kind of lushly drawn moments. I mean, what was your response to the kind of Gilbert doing these longer, ambitious stories, and what was kind of your artistic development, do you think, as you kind of got into the main part of the Love and Rockets series? How did you see what you wanted to do with yourself?
I don't know, but I was just doing my work as usual, and whatever, wherever the comic started to turn, I'd follow. Right. Gilbert started to do something longer, I thought, I'd love to do something longer. You know, it was no real mastermind, it was just kind of like where the groove of the comic was going. You know? I remember when I was, after I finished the mechanics stuff, in the teens issues, you know, I was just having a short Maggie Hopi slice of life stuff like this. You know, and because I just wanted to draw, girls at the barbershop, you know, kind of thing. And I was just writing stories around, like, say, this image. You know, I thought of this image and I wrote a whole story around it. And they were just kind of slice of life stuff. And while I was doing that, though, Gilbert was doing, like, Bull Nets and Bracelets, The Laughing Sun, and Holiday, and stuff like that. And I remember feeling really dumb. he's writing real stories here. This comic isn't just a goof. You know, it's not. There's something really serious going on with Gilbert's stuff. And I just felt like I had to step it up. I was just like, I don't regret the stuff that was going on, the slice of life stuff, because that created my two characters, the beloved Maggie and Holby, you know, that kind of created who they were. But, it wasn't until the return of Ray D, right before Death of Speedy, that I actually did a story from front to beginning that was actually structured, you know.
Sure.
And I found out I could do it. So
here's the story of mine. I'm older, so I remember. Mario was my older brother Mario. Well, one day I walked into the room and he was drawing a Superman comic. I'm 5 years old. I said, "Oh, I have to draw a Superman comic book too." It was just this weird sense of duty out of where I came from. So I named him the Spaceman comic. I didn't quite finish it. The only was exhausted after 3 panels or whatever. But I remember hiding it, and then we would do a few of these comics, and then hide it and did the same thing. The other reason he was 2 years younger, and he chose, "Oh, I have to do my comics too." So I made his own comics. But Jaime, even if he was so much younger, he would come up with his own type of comics. He didn't like look at our and go, "Oh, I'm going to do that too." He just, from his imagination, would do comics. Jaime did a run of Batman and Animals for Christmas. Too bad they don't exist anymore. Because they were just very fabulous. They were just like little kids. But he would have this meticulous, like, "I don't feel like drawing what comic books look like." He'll just draw like panels of Batman in a square body, and he'd put all this little detail in it. And that was something I looked at, like, because I was always trying to approximate a real comic. But I didn't care. He just went, "Okay, this is what Batman's going to look like in this comic. And this is what he's going to look like." And sometimes the comics can get past like a cover and maybe a page or something. And I noticed that uniqueness in his art right away. So since he's a very small child, he could do that. So as I would develop into doing my comics, didn't know that I was stealing from Marvel comics. And I was getting all these ideas.
I thought he had great stories.
I was selecting from excellent comics and stuff, but making them my own, my crude way. And but I did also get like, "Oh, I gotta do my comics." And he'd always come up with his own thing. And that continued until Love and Rockets, where older brother and always said, "Oh, we can print this fanzine." You got anything? And I just had abandoned in my first story laying around. I had another stuff before that I wanted to do. I go, "I don't want to print old stuff right now. But let me just finish this story." And so then I says, "Oh, I don't want to print anything. Well, I'll just do something new." And, and Mario and I figured it was going to be like it always was. Mario would have all these ideas and stuff. I would have my comics and I would have his version. We see the first pages of Locus, the stuff, and we're like, "Who was this guy? This is not our brother. Who is this guy?" But then at the same time, I recognized that was also the progression of mine. It was small. Even though he didn't have a great skill in drawing, he still knew what he was doing. And that was always present in his art. And so when we started on Rockets, luckily the timing was right, that he was able to, with this style of drawing, start out right away. And so that's the story of Honey Man and Lime Sticks Location.
And from my point of view, I was just the fourth in line. Mario did the best, then Gilbert, then Richard, then me, and then there was my little brother, and then my sister. So it was my duty to stand in line behind, that kind of thing. So when they did their work, it was like, how can I compete with this? They were much older than me, much more polished. And I kind of just said, well, I just got to do what I do. It was just that.
I wanted to thank you for this comic. I think this is the best alternative comic that was ever made. The best alternative single issue comic book. This comic, unless I completely screwed this up, this is a comic that has 4 stories by Jaime and it has your Frida Kahlo story in it. But an amazing story. And 2 of the 4 stories are kind of all-timers. The Tear It Up, Tear It Down, in particular, is an amazing 3-pager, I think, for me that's in there. And all the stories are really beautiful that are in that issue. And I can't imagine if you ever see this in a box. I have no idea why I put it in the presentation other than to praise it. But I honestly think that's the best alternative comic that's ever been created. This didn't get it any better than that one.
Well, it hurts my feeling a little bit because there's no Palomar. It's just... I doubt it.
Can I ask you about one question I had about this? What did you find? You were very early then on Frida, kind of reappraising her. I remember looking her up when I was in college, and there wasn't a whole lot of material. This was actually one of the things you could go to kind of learn about her. And I just wondered what was about the imagery Because you told her story in her own, you appropriating a lot of her images into the.
Yeah, I had known Frida before, you know, from a friend who's simply, he was a fan of hers and he knew her history and such. He suggested I read a book of her, my story, of hating her, Frida. And I did, just for fun, really. I just wanted to read about, you know, Alex Bernard Parson. And I liked it, so it didn't really connect to me as a comic. I just spotted it as a story, and then I went back to comic. And so what happened is, Mario and I were doing a story on the Rockets that just fell through. It just was not coming together. The story was just falling apart. We just couldn't get together on it. It was taking too long to do. So I thought, yeah, I got to film. I go, you know what, let's push that story back. I got to fill in. This is a film story, basically. And I don't have any material. I can't do anything that fast. I don't have any ideas that fast. And the film was already late, and I just thought, I got Frida. Nobody knows about Frida, so I was, you know, literally, it was like that. And so I just jumped into it. And I have to credit Kim Thompson a lot for it, because I did it real fast, and I wrote it real fast, and it was really a jumble. The writing, the adaptation was really a jumble. And then Kim came in and just straightened it out. I mean, he tore it apart and straightened it. Within days, we just put it together. And so he's actually, I give him a lot of credit for putting that together. But my feelings are still hurt because it's not a television show.
That's just an amazing image. I don't really remember why I had that in there. I'm going to talk about, you know, you guys, at the end of the first series of Love and Rockets, went off and did your own comics. New Love, I think, is one of the most underrated books of all time. It's an amazing series. I think if you only did New Love, that's all the comics you'd ever done, we'd still have to consider you a formidable cartoonist. I just wonder what was going on that you kind of went this. There's a lot of experimental work or a lot of different like short stories that are done in different styles. And I just wondered what was going on that you decided that was what you would do after Love and Rockets was over. What caused that break? What you went with when you did New Love?
I'll say what happened. Well, I was so dumb that I thought that I was going to make money because that's why. I thought, well, I have no comics, I have all the pages, I'll just do whatever I want. I thought, you know, the audience was following me like sheep. No, everybody kept away from it, like the play. I didn't realize we wanted to be continuing now. I thought, you know, everybody's done with it, you know. So I don't know why I came with that idea. And I just had that scratching itch. I just wanted to do something different, experimental. Whatever I woke up that morning thinking, what would be a good story? And I did. That's Bob Hope having a heroin. I just did it because they just to do it. And also, we just liked the idea of having our own comics. And I really haven't had one yet. And I thought, let's just do it. Let's just bring away from Lone Rockets. Let's get away from the repetition that I felt was setting in. And it's just a crazy stuff. I could have done this in Love and Rockets, but I just need a different format. I have to look different, feel different. I have to go to a different neighborhood to do this. So that's why I did it. And they just didn't really last very long because they're more labor intensive. And our readers were still looking for Love and Rockets, even though we were doing the same thing. So we just sort of threw our hands up and started Love and Rockets again.
I mean, what was that experience like for you? I mean, have your own comic then?
Oh, it was the same. It was just kind of like, I'm a kid again. You know, Love and Rockets 50, just a bogged down in continuity, and just something had to end. You know, even if you don't kill the characters off or anything, just something had to cut off. And then this was just like a breath of fresh air. Even if I was still doing Maggie and Hobie stories, just giving them a new hairstyle and a new job just opened up their world for me, you know.
As I recall, you know, there was a big switch. Also, you brought in Ray as kind of a narrative voice more explicitly and kind of worked with him.
Because I was itching to tell it from a guy's point of view. Hey, Ray's the poor soul who, you know, walks through the city with his hands in his pockets, he's broke, stuff like that. It's the less the characters have, the more they have to talk about, you know. It was just fun, and it just felt new. You know, I don't know if it was new. I mean, it's the same. There's Penny Century, you know. me going to the comic store and seeing a new comic, you know. But like you said, it didn't sell.
Actually, got a couple like the single images. I think you guys are really interesting. When you guys go for like a single moment, it's very interesting. And I kind of wondered if either one of you might answer that. Is there when you're doing comics, your comics is very much about pushing the eye around on the page and kind of driving people to different points on the page and telling your stories. And when you use a single image, and maybe, you know, these weren't, well, that's a cover image, as I recall, but I mean, to go with a single image in a book, when you kind of stop the eye and make people focus on something, how do you balance that on the page? Is that just by feel? Like you just want to, do you think of even in terms of moving people's attention around, or is it kind of balancing?
No, we just feel it out. I don't have an intellectual long thought. I just feel it. And this is basically me saying, fuck you, on the phone. Really, that's it. I just had a chip on my shoulder. I thought I was punk, even though I was 32. And I just did it. I just still have that attitude. You know, I go, this is going to piss people off, but it's going to piss off the right people.
This is Bullnecks and Bracelets, right? This one and that's Tear It Up, Tear It Down. And it's kind of two of your stories where both of you use a classic technique that people see as one of your kind of core techniques, which is jump cuts, or big, broad kind of jumps between one panel to the next, or one moment to the next. I mean, that probably is a feel thing as well as you guys, but it seems like you guys, that came a little later, that you kind of discovered this tool that you could kind of trust the reader to kind of follow you on these stories. Would that be a correct portrayal?
I would say it's by that time trusting that the reader was smart enough to be there. I mean, I never thought my readers would down ever, but just that
they would get it.
Like movies jump cut all the time. I mean, you know, I thought, why can't comics? You know,
you guys are great cover designers. Another thing I don't think you guys get a lot of credit for. And I wondered if both of you could talk a little bit, just in broad terms, what makes an effective cover for you, or if how you, maybe even how you kind of approach the empty page or that initial design. Yeah.
Well, there was one thing I remember Gilbert said years early on in 11 Rockets. He goes, our comics gotta call you from across the room. You go into the comic store, ours is going to be the first one you see. So we kind of borrowed from old comics, from the history, the comics that kind of jumped out at us, and what images, you know, kind of drew you in.
In particular, there's a comic group that DC bought a long time ago. They're in the 40s, they're called Quality Comics, and they were where you saw Plastic Man comics and then different kinds like that. And oftentimes they wouldn't have backgrounds on the cover. It would just have a flat color and then the action in the middle. And even though a lot of comic fans like a lot of detail, more detail in the title, like, look at that comic, detail. I like the ones that just jumped out at me. Just to think of your Plastic Man turning sort of a hoop or something, and Lucy Riggs is swinging on it, and that was it. The blue background and that. And that one just jumped out at me. So I thought of that to myself doing covers where they just jump out at me. I mean, the detail stuff works. Obviously, the first issue of Love Rockets is what got to have to notice. You know, it's all detail. But I was like, and it was, you know, it was more competition as an artistic competition, not necessarily we were going to, you know, outsell that kind of comic. But we know that, you know, whenever I was going to look at a rack of comics, I looked at the image and jumped out and got the super detail. You see that in magazine covers, they'll just have a model face or just a model standing there, or whatever. Very simple, very direct. And with this kind of drawing that I do, it's very 1950s-ish. The first two covers, and the last one, or the last two. It's just a thick line, it just jumps out at you, just jump. And I didn't know if that was going to work. That was just an idea that felt right, more than that. Which, like I said, even if you plan things to work, that doesn't mean they're going to. You just hope they will.
Sure. You guys are also great character designers. Question I had about your character designs. I mean, how much of that is preparation? Like, do you work on the designs, or do those kind of naturally come out on the page? How much prep work is there?
Sometimes there's a lot of prepping. Like, I have a character in the new issue I'm finishing now that I read over and over. until she was right, you know, now it works. But, and then sometimes a character will just be drawn in the background, and then you go, you say, okay, I need a character for this scene. Well, I'll use this one. She, that person looked pretty good. You know, sometimes it's an accident, you know. But, and sometimes, like, you know, it's labor because I'm thinking, like, this character's got to last. I want this, so I want to draw this person all the time, you know. And then sometimes it's just, like, I have too many blonde-haired characters. I'm going to have a dark-haired character. I have too many dark-eyed characters. You know, this is stuff like that.
In the early days it was easier because all the characters were new. So I could, that's why the characters in Palma are all different. And now the characters that are going in all the same. Well, it's because I run out of looks for people. Because I don't want to repeat the Palmer show. Palmer is important to me to stay Palomar, to be a time capsule or, you know, what I was doing there. And so to repeat what characters looks is very important not to do that. So I work really hard on certain characters. Like I said, sometimes a quickly designed character works best for longevity, and sometimes they don't. It depends. You got to, sometimes I've created characters that I'm sorry the way I designed them. I won't tell you which ones, but I'm sorry the way they look because I'm stuck with the look of that character. So now I try to back off and draw, something that looks different from the others. But but after a while, I draw so many faces, especially on a pretty gal, if you're running out of pretty faces to draw, you know. So ugly faces are easier because, you know, whatever you want to design, but, you know. But a pretty face is usually because of the symmetry of the face. And after a while, you have to use so much symmetry in a pretty face. Even a good looking guy, they start to look the same, you know. So that's a challenge. It may make them look different now more than ever because, you know, I just have so many characters. The readers know about my characters more than I do now.
And I used to change hairstyles a lot. You know, like Maggie has changed her hair a lot. And I started to slow that down only so I wouldn't run out of hairstyles.
You said you might need a hairstyle for another character. Yeah, it's stuff like that. It's really bad.
You know, you tell a lot of stories with the characters of different ages. I'm always amazed by how your characters signify at different ages, that you can tell that they are those characters. And I wondered how difficult that was, even, to make sure that you can tell that this, you know, to age and de-age characters, and how design kind of plays into that process. Like, what is it, I mean, did that take a while to get to that?
Actually, it's not that difficult for me. It's, I guess because when I'm thinking of the character, like, okay, what were they like at 3? All I'm thinking about really is what was their haircut like, and what was their they dress like? What did Maggie dress? Let's see, she was 5 in 1970. What did my sister wear? You know, my sister's the same age. You know, that kind of thing. So I don't know how if I don't remember if, you know, when I draw, you know, that's not Maggie. You know, it just worked.
It's funny, the frame of reference a lot of readers have is actually pretty limited. These are always considered Heinz Peanuts drawings. But this is actually from the Hank Ketchum School.
Sure.
Where there's more naturalism and depth to the drawing. And, I mean, there's, of course, there's a lot of Peanuts in it, but Hank Ketchum and his ghost artist, Owen Fitzgerald, were, you know, just such the most brilliant people artists there have been. And that's what we gravitate to.
Is it difficult when the characters are interrelated as much as your characters are? They're different families and mothers and daughters.
And how
they look, yeah. The design of them.
Well, you know, it's easy. For what it wasn't, like I said early on. On Guadalupe, instead of looking like Luba, she looks like Rocky. And that's just to make it the family connection thing, you know.
You guys know, I don't think you guys get as much credit as you should for your all ages, or your contributions to all ages comics. And one thing is, you guys simply drew in a lot of styles. I mean, we have you talk about the Hank Ketchum style, but you guys have drawn styles that are kind of, were seen as out of favor in comics, as comics were really mature and serious, and you guys were, you know, always had found joy and found pleasure and found use out of styles that were kind of out of favor. Mm-hmm. But you guys have also done a lot of comics in that, that can be seen as all ages. Gilbert, I mean, what is, you were very early on in kind of this wave of kids' comics that we have now, the Venus stuff, I think, of Measles, the comic series. What took you there that you wanted to do those kind of comics again? What did you see that you wanted to do that? Was it just an urge to do that kind of comic coalition, or did you see something that was missing?
Yeah, it's usually that, in part nostalgia, because I mean, they don't kid comics anymore. I'm like, oh, awesome. I mean, that's literally how we approach comics. We just wake up in the morning and feel differently about what we want to do that day. I don't want to drive anybody in the shot in the head today. What about kid comics? You know, it's literally, it's like, that's how quick the brain is. Yeah, Venus, you know, I just decided, you know, I want my own little Archie Dennis the Menace, little Doc, little Lulu type character. Just, you know, overall, I always like kid characters, especially when they're little girls for some reason. I just like how more expressive they were than boy characters. Back then, you know, doing Venus. As a matter of fact, that's why the lead character in Marvel season is a boy. Not because it's a semi-autobiographical story, but I had already done Venus. And I didn't want to, you know. And I do plan in the future, probably I'm going to do a graphic novel, a Venus graphic novel, when she's this age. Now she's an adult, but I probably want to do it just because she's such a fun character to write. You know, she's all over the place, you know, but you know, she's projecting herself within this little girl character. But I just wanted to do that. I think, hey, you want to come to your own. You know, really, it's just what I feel like doing.
I mean, what do you do? Well, Nellie was an all is readable by all ages, as far as I know. I mean, what takes you there then? You don't have as much. You don't have the prolific. There's not the prolific quality to your output where you can do a bunch of different comics. But what takes you to an all ages comic when you go there then? Why this one? Why a couple of the other short things that you've done?
I just didn't need anything adult in it. You know, in the story, in the, Wo Nellie came because it was right after Lone Rockets 50, and I just wanted to go on autopilot. And it was supposed to be more of a, it originally was supposed to be more of like a wrestling magazine where there's photos of action from wrestling scenes, and I was just going to put big titles like, Somebody loses title, or something like that. But the storyteller in me always takes over, and I decided to make that. But going back to your question, what was the question?
Who knows at this point? Yeah. I guess, you know, you just haven't done a lot of all ages, and I just kind of wondered what took you there. I mean, is that something you'd like to do more of, I guess, would be a question. Is or is it just, it seems like you're
really well, it's for me, a lot of the Maggie Hopi stuff is all ages. Yeah. It's just all in between. You know, you can't go, I can maybe pick out an issue and go, oh, a kid can read this one, but then you can't read the next one. You know, the first comic of mine my daughter read is Brown Town. Now, that's not before she was, 12? I let her read up to page 16. Page 17 has naked boys. Starts naked boys. 16 is just Maggie's angst of growing up and becoming a teenager. And she liked it. And she was like, how come I can't read the next stuff? And my wife and I were very much. Not for a while. But I'm afraid that, you know, she's lost interest by now. She's 14. She's getting close to being able to read more. I think she's not going to care about that.
I crossed my fingers that Marvel season would be okay because in the past, little kid stuff, not very few people are interested in kid comics. They just aren't. So thinking of, when I came up with Marvel season, I thought, well, this is going to be pure kid comic, but it's got to appeal to the adults. So you know, I look for things that would appeal to adults as well.
What would be something? The nostalgic?
The nostalgia and talking specifically about the particular obsessions of comics and monster movies and that, which everybody comics, older comics fans are.
You know, we mentioned earlier that you have a lot, of work that's not under the Love and Rockets umbrella, not under Palomar, that. I mean, do you look at that work differently? Do you take on projects like the comics you do with Dark Horse, which is two of those, and you've done Vertigo comics? Did those play a different role? Do you stretch different muscles?
Yeah, well, these two books in particular have the ones that got me least with at least good response in tech. Especially this one, Speaking of Devil, but it's basically the serial killer story, and I just, all my ugly elements are in the story, and only hyper-violent elements are in the Fatima and the other story. That's just because I really like doing that stuff, but I just know there's one reader wants to see that from me. And I do it anyway. And just because I go, I want to turn this on, but I'll have to check it off the brain. You know, and this was just, I just wanted a light version of a serial killer slasher story, but my version. I trust my instincts that when I want subject to take, I'll do the overhanded version. Well, good or bad, whatever that is, that's what I'm going to do. Speaking of the devil, is either loved or extremely hated from me. And that's when my mind started to separate. And it's been like that since. So naturally, you know, I've been asking why I keep doing it. You know, so that's why I have the Love and Rockets. But that's why they are separate, because I know I can't mix that stuff anymore. I will start to lose all my readers if I have to mix it too much. That's what I suspect. I just like doing it because I like that kind of material, and I like doing it. But I know I can only do so much of it, because I'll just end up in a gutter.
How many did the maybe, I think, you know, the one of the most celebrated comics of the last 5 years, and the two issues of Love and Rockets New Story, your guys' current title, The Brown Town, and then followed by, this is Love Bunglers, or one of the spreads from that kind of that ending story there. That whole suite of stories. I mean, did you know that was a powerful work early on when you were doing it? Were you surprised by the kind of gut reaction that people had to that, to both of those suites of stories, maybe particularly the second group?
It was kind of like how when we started, I hoped it would get a good, big response. It got bigger than I thought, you know. It was, Brown Town was one of them and stories that just fell out of, spilled out of my head, and I watched it happen, and I was so happy with where there was not one loose end to it. It was just one of the tightest stories I've done. Without being too compact, you know. It was able to breathe, but it had every single element I wanted from it. And I was so happy with it, and I was just hoping other people.
I mean, the economy of the storytelling is amazing. I mean, does this image here, does the different expressions on the kid's face, and there's four different stories, and, you know, and a fifth with the dialogue in, like, one image. I mean, the kind of the effectiveness and the substantive quality of, you know, panel to panel work is really amazing in that story. And then, of course, you know, this one was
now this one. This one, I was actually surprised that knocked people out because I did it as just kind of a between scene kind of thing. You know, I wanted, you know, the story to slow down to a dream quality before it continued. You know, so when I did this, I was like, hey, I'll do it every time when they met, every time, you know, they met. And then it started to become something, and I thought, well, this is kind of cute, this works, you know, kind of that. But the response, I didn't expect. Maybe some people saw this as total magic, and I'm just going to argue with them.
What's weird when we do this stuff, you know, you did a great, amazing job on this, but we're not thinking of that. We're just thinking of, like, oh, this works. It's not like, this is magic, we're going to win an award. No, it's more like, hey, this works. Magic, great. Look at the first panel of that. This page, we see Ray looking at Maggie, and this page, it's the same scene, but Maggie looking at Ray. But it's more of, I mean, I'm just guessing, guess what I'm saying? Is that we just feel it out as, okay, this is good for the story. But we never think it's anything bigger than that.
Yeah. And you know, and then as it's starting to come together, and I'm happy with it, I'm going, I'm hoping there's, you know, one person that'll say, oh, it's the character, oh, you know.
I mean, is there ever a danger, because you have to know how much affection that people have for your sets of main characters. Is there ever... Do you ever find yourself not worrying about being manipulative with the characters? Because it would be easy to kind of tug on the heartstrings in a way. I mean, is that, or are you kind of that kind of authentic with the characters that that's not really a concern?
These types of stories are more personal stories, especially the one from Little Rockets. We don't think of anything other than we're just trying to get the story done and what means something to us. And we're always, like I said, we're always crossing fingers that the reader will accept that. And so when people tell who tells they like the comic, it's more like, whew, now we can go get on to the next thing. You know, like, because, you know, when people say, oh, that was a terrible story. I mean, you know, we do hear it once in a great while, but it's like, you know.
Yeah. Though there was parts of Love, the end of Love Bundlers when I was writing scenes, and I remember I had two extra pages to fill. And those are the two pages where it's in between where Maggie gets really heavy, and she's on a blind date, and she's pretty depressed and stuff like that. I remember that just I wrote that like in one night, you know, and as I was drawing it, I was like, okay, and then I'll have her in the bathroom just bawling. Oh boy, that's where I was going with it. We're tugging the heartstring.
Marvel season pages. Can you talk about that choice with the, with this new book?
I was thinking, I was thinking along the lines of old comic strips that would have had an immediate impact, that, like, say, Peanuts or the old Nancy comic strip, or thing like that. I'm paraphrasing, but I think it's a quote from the artist Wally Wood about the Nancy comic strip. Basically, he just said, by the time you don't want to read Nancy, you've already read it. It's so immediate. And I just wanted that in this story. I wanted to read like your young person. Adults are reading this, but your young person. And you get the drawing immediately. You know exactly what's going on. There's no explanation. It's very simple. The backgrounds are very sparse. And I just wanted a complete immediate reaction when kids respond to the story, even though, it's written for all ages. Well, that's all. Just wanted the simplest, most direct way. Because I normally act like on panels and jump cuts and flashbacks and stuff like that just because I like to. But this was just like, no, I'm just going to tell the kid's story from point A to B and just not mess around with any artistic bullshit. Just put it straight.
Why that? You remember why that decision, Naomi? What was it that you wanted to be direct about this work? Was it just the nature of the story, the fact that it was a kid's story? Was it just...
I just wanted to approximate what it felt like. You can't. It was a direct line. You were just were there. And the worst problem of the day was thinking what you're going to do next. At least at that period of your life, or before when things were good when you're a kid. And then you meet the crazy neighbor kid that completely ruined, changes your whole perspective, yet you kind of earn into it, because as a kid you still can absorb and learn things every day, whereas adults, resist that, learning something every day. I was just because I wanted to direct the program, it was straight for the entertainment value, and that was really it. Like I said, we just feel out what we want to do. One day we wake up and say, I want to do something complex and violent, the next day it's like, I get a kid's comic and I'll just back out.
This is you guys, one of the Rolling Stone interview photos.
They look like the Rolling Stones.
with Chris and Dan. Are you guys, that was kind of a remarkable show, and you guys are here as well. Do you guys feel comfortable in this kind of role where people are kind of paying attention to you because of the 30 years, and that you guys are the older guys now that you used to be? Is that a good place to be? I remember at the Ignatz's, which is the SBX Awards, you kind of gave this like really sweet admonishment to someone who won the best new talent that they couldn't quit and they would have to keep doing comics and I saw you Gilbert talk with Michael DeForge, the very talented young cartoonist. So I know that some of the younger cartoonists took that opportunity to come meet you guys. Mm-hmm. Is that a good place to be? Do you guys feel comfortable kind of being those guys that people look towards as kind of established, masters of the?
The easy, fun part is coming to something like this because I just have to sit here
and talk about myself.
Yeah. Drawing the comics, a whole different story. You're like, oh, are they going to like this? Is my career over? Kind of thing. But come here. Hey, I did the work already. Here for the work I've done. So that's the easy part. Now I get to relax.
This time it's a bunch of the... the early 40-something crowd, maybe?
Ron Ricci.
Ron Ricci. Jordan Crane, yeah. Sammy Harkham, and Frankie Santoro. Yeah. So, except for maybe Sammy, most guys, in their early 40s.
That's the only time I hang out with cartoonists when someone will come into town and they'll all go, hey, let's go to dinner. That's all the LA guys. But, that's the only time. That's the only time I'm out there.
Do you feel connection though? We started talking about how you guys felt connected to some of the, and Gilbert, you're going to do your slide presentation at the show on some of your influences directly. Uh-huh. And we talked about how you guys felt in terms of the older cartoonists, the undergrads, and some of the mainstream guys. Do you feel connected to the younger cartoonists? Because there's going to be a lot of them on the floor tomorrow. There are probably a lot of them here. Do you feel like that they... of a type with the guys, or something that you would communicate to them if you could, to kind of that you think that they could learn from looking at your comics, or how do you feel about
that? Well, see, that's kind of a tricky question because there have been times, especially before the internet, got bumped off the, there's Hate and Eight Ball, Love and Rockets. Then there's Hate and Eight Ball and Chris Ware. And then we just got bumped up off the list, or whatever. That didn't make me stop drawing comics, but I was just really out of it and didn't have that connection. It hasn't all been until a few years ago that I'm actually meeting people who were born after we started the comic that actually talked to me about my stuff, and I'm like, oh, really? You read it? I'm like, gee whiz, I had no idea, that kind of thing. So, it's great. It's wonderful. I mean, to meet someone, it's easier when they know your work. If I have to explain myself one more time to a parent at my daughter's school, what I do for a living, I'm going to kill myself.
Well, I answered that question. The question that people always ask is, what do you read first? And I always say whatever's closest. I mean, that's what you read if your guys is first. What get your hands on it, just start reading. But if there's a guy like a guy from the gym or a guy, the neighbor, what would you tell them if they said, I'd like to read one of your books? What would you give someone who hadn't read your books before?
I usually just give them the latest because I have copies, and I don't expect anything back. I rarely expect any feedback.
I just get a kind of a copy. Well, this is going to be worth $10,000. I'll take $5,000 for this issue. No, I just don't even bother them. I don't bother these guys. The Avengers. That's close to the comics I talk about. The Avengers. Avengers. He's really gonna agree to that. It's what's weird now is that you talk about it. It's happened so fast that I remember. It's just weird that you pick your mind those guys. Those are the young guys, And then there's even younger guys than that. And then there's younger and younger. So it is weird to be the old guys. It's a little weird because I think I'm 30 years old still. I'm not, so then I remember going to parties. And this is how old I am. I remember going to parties where it was Jack Kirby and Will Eisner and Harvey Kurtz talking to each other.
Yeah.
I mean, they're there, alive and well, and talking away. And then another party where it was Gil Kane and Robert Crumb and Harvey Kurtz talking to each other. Just weird configurations like that. But we took it for granted. Like, they were the old guys and they were the young guys. So it's like, oh, there they are. I'll talk to him later. That kind of thing. Oh, I'll talk to Harvey Kurtzman later. he's busy. I'll talk to him later. Same with Eisner. I saw Eisner so much that it was like, I just stopped saying hi to him going out of the way. Fuck with me. And then, especially Jack Kirby. We knew Jack Kirby, but we never hung out with him. Because I think it was an unconscious, intimidation. We just felt so, he was such reverence for us that I just couldn't be a normal person around him, so I kind of avoided him, actually. I'd say, hi, how you doing, Jack? How are you kidding everybody? Just okay, Jack, see that? I just get all so nervous, And now I just regret those times. I could have spent so much time with him, But now we're those old guys, and nobody wants to spend time with
him. So basically, anybody who wants to hang out with you this weekend got his biggest open opportunity. That is kind of the entirety of my questions for you. They wanted to leave me to have a few minutes for questions from the audience. After that, they're going to do a signing in the back of the room at the table and back. So I guess we can take, if you guys are still willing to take a few questions from the audience, I guess shouting them.
I do have to apologize for this drawing, though, because I know this is a big call-up panel for me, but Luba's tits are so big that it's like, how does anybody take this? Seriously. I don't think it's seriously. And unfortunately, I stuck a little bit in the front. I should have put it in the back panel. Because people really like that panel when I was coming around. What it says there. But I always ruin my comics with fucking Jesus Christ. All right. You guys are in. I'll stop it.
Do we have any questions from the... Yes, this the lady bed right there.
Hi. I've been a huge fan since about 88. I wonder if you would speak a bit to ethnicity in your work. Butler. We had seen her understanding as a Black American woman reflected in sci-fi, and she brought that to her writing. And I guess I see in your work a kind of similarity with, it's not just satire. It kind of is deconstructing the tropes, maybe unconsciously, you know. And I've read a few interviews or comments where you've spoken a bit to your experience as Latin men and how this has fed into your work. I wondered if you had experienced a challenge or debate around that early in your career, or how it continued to affect you.
If there was any problems anybody had with the Latino element, you know, nobody ever told us. I heard, you know, maybe like third hand, like, oh, there's too many Mexicans in it. Okay, yeah. So, but anyway, it was, for me, it was if you heard any stupid shit like that, it was third hand, really. Yeah. But nobody ever bothered us for it.
But at the same time, putting the multi-ethnicity in the comic came from how the real world worked, how, you know, people hated Mexicans or whatever, you know. So that was, you know, a big reason of why we kept that up. And besides the fact that we are Mexican and we had so much stories to tell of our culture, and took advantage of the fact that there was so little of it out there. Yeah.
Another question? Yes, sir.
I have one. Given the narrative and character strength of Love and Rockets, how come there's never been in 30 years a film adaptation, or is it just too late for that?
Well, I'll tell my version. We've been approached by, Time Warner. We've been approached by a guy with a camcorder. And it never comes... nobody can ever figure out what it's supposed to be. And the trouble with Hollywood is they want you to tell them what it's about to be so they can take the credit. Well, that's not going to happen. You know, you want our story, you have to pay us an option, like most people. You try shopping around, and then we'll start talking about stuff. But they never want to get to that point. They want us to write a script on spec, and if they like it, then maybe they'll shop it around and take credit for it. And, but it's all been that problem. There was never any... Every one of our peers got an option for a movie, and we never had. So fuck them.
Has the prevalence of long form serious television drama changed the way that those deals have come to you? Because I know that there, it seems like, when you hear about things like, The Wire having an amazingly diverse cast. It's no more diverse than your guys' cast. Or when you hear about The Sopranos bringing background characters into the foreground, that's something that you guys did. Yeah. Has that changed the offers or even changed your interest in seeing?
Well, I would say more that offers recently are talking about HBO series or Showtime or whatever. That's how I'm approached. But it's still the same thing. So we want to do this, so do it. And I'm like, I got a comic book to draw, man. You come back to me when you got something.
Yeah. But I have to add to what I just mean, what is the explosion of the second. There's a man in this room who has a good chance of getting a Paddle Martin role. So there is a chance of that. There is he's an old friend, and I think we have a good chance of getting something kind of Paddle Martin out there. And he really knows the material. I think it's gonna happen. It's just that I just won't be able to deal with fucking Taiwan. That's for sure. Unless they're financing me.
We have a couple more. One more question. Someone have a question? I think that they'll be signing in the back. You guys are here all weekend, signing with Johnny Quarterly Gilbert with the new book. I may be at Fantagraphics. I think you both may be at Fantagraphics at some point.
Yeah.
I hope you'll see their exhibits and events, and I hope that you'll join me in thanking them right now.